Hello, welcome to Sapientia. I'm James.
And I'm Justin.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's an outtake. Hello, welcome to Sapientia. I'm Justin.
And I'm James.
And this is our religion episode.
It's going to be a big one. I've put a bad taste in Justin's mouth already about religion because I was late to filming because I was at church a lot later than I was expecting to be.
Happens. How dare you?
I know. God bless me. I'm such a bad person for doing that. But we hope this is going to be a spicy episode for you. And I've asked Justin perhaps to indulge us a little bit into how religion has been in his life, because that's kind of where we're starting this episode.
Oh, you want me to go over that first?
Oh, sure.
It's been an interesting ride, to say the least. So my mom is Buddhist, but more of the kind of popular Buddhism you find. So if you read, I mean, this is my personal take on Buddhism, but if you read the Dhammapada and then you look at what actual Buddhists do, there's a little bit of incongruency in my opinion. But in general, she was a Buddhist, but very casually.
So more like the Mahayana kind of thing, or
Yeah, something like that. Zen, perhaps.
okay.
I never actually questioned her too much because she was so casual about it. She basically never talked about it. I went from that to being a Christian for some period of time, for like 2 or 3 years. That was when I was pretty young. I think I was exposed to it mainly through babysitters and friends of the family. And I got really serious about it because when I was young, I had depression and I had a lot of social issues, especially. But I grew out of that when I was like 12, 13, because it just stopped working for me. Then I went about studying a bunch of different religions or religious ideas like Satanism, Hinduism, paganism, you name it. I probably looked at it at one point and thought I was that, and then quickly realized I wasn't. I was solidly an atheist up until college and beyond. Now I would characterize my views as more humanist. So I'm still technically atheist in that I don't believe in a god in the literal sense. But I'm not opposed to having, well, we'll get into this, but to preface, my perspective on religion has been being through all of this, having been through atheism, it's hard to go through life without having a narrative, without have something to aggregate all of your life experiences under. And religion often is that for a lot of people. And I've noticed in my forays in atheism, it's really hard to like try to have this, objective, impersonal view of the world when you're a subject living in reality.
Right.
So hence why I say I'm more of a humanist now, because I have a perspective. I have a position on metaphysical questions, on the human trajectory, and on the human experience.
Right. Well, and it's hard to claim to be staunchly atheist whenever you have very few experiences in your life, because
True.
you have nothing to model it on. And I think I had said in some previous episode that I had kind of danced around in there a little bit, and I actually ran into that same problem. I didn't feel like I really had any direction, and I was already depressed when I stopped going to church, and it just spiraled out of control from there. So that kind of leads us into our first question, or one of our first questions, just on like how. Well, why don't we define religion first?
Yeah, that's
That might be helpful.
All right, so I will read to you the literal definition. Well, a literal definition pulled off Wikipedia. Religion is a social cultural system of designated behaviors and practices, morals, worldviews, texts, sanctified places, prophecies, ethics, or organizations that relates humanity to the supernatural, transcendental, or spiritual elements. However, there is no scholarly consensus over what precisely constitutes a religion.
So we're working in slightly relativistic grounds, but for the sake of our arguments and presentation, we'll stick with that definition.
Mm-hmm.
Just so we have some standard to measure by.
So there's a few things we should delve into when we're also talking about religion, because I think that there are some ways in which we often end up talking past each other. So the first one that I want to delve into is the position of faith in religion qua. This is especially pertinent to Christianity, because a lot of Christianity is concerned with faith, but also in other religions too, because many religions are predicated on having faith in a certain set of ideas and cultures and traditions, whereas they don't, a lot of the times it's not predicated on, like, here's the evidence, you know, find the answers.
Yeah. And you know, just to speak a bit about faith in Christianity, it's not like you don't have to, you know, have faith in, you know, the word in the Bible is, like, that's the word of God. For Christians, like, that's not something you even believe. That's something that you just accept. That is truth. Where the faith comes from is miracles and things like that. Or, you know, you have to have faith that, you know, God will keep you safe through whatever you're dealing with, or will give you some kind of clarity, nudge, you know, kick in the butt, if it were, to, you know, get you in the right direction. But ultimately, that's where that faith is. And I think, speaking of, like, faith and spirituality and things like that, there's a bit of conflation of spirituality and religion sometimes.
Oh,
I think,
sure.
In that.
Yeah.
And so it's about spirituality, but it's more personal than that. You're worried about your personal spiritual self, and that's, you take care of that through your faith. I don't really know where I was going with that. I just kind of threw it out there.
No, that's a good summation, and I'm glad you brought up the distinction between spirituality and religion. It's important to say, for the context of this discussion, we are talking about religions qua, so you're usually looking at social institutions or some form of communal organization. Spirituality is not religion in the sense that I can be a spiritual person but have no connection to the community whatsoever. So if you think of, it's really hard too, because some Buddhists practice in isolation,
right?
But they're still part of a culturally located tradition and a diaspora of ideas that started with some, you know, set of people, right? But I can be a spiritual person, have a set of ideas that aren't connected with that kind of cultural tradition and mythos. And a good example of this would be a lot of New Age thought, whereas it does have some connection with paganism, for instance. But like, I can pick and choose what I take from those.
Right.
And that's generally a good indication that you're, like, a spiritual person but not a religious person.
Certainly. One might even say that Martin Luther was more of a spiritual person than a religious person by that particular view. And so too the history of Protestantism. Not to anger all of you Protestants, but it's just kind of the way the history goes.
But that's where it gets interesting too, right? Because our regard for Protestants as religious, I think, does stem from this understanding that you can trace their tradition back to, you know, the Catholic Church and back through history to the inceptions of Christianity, right? Even though they do have these branching points. This is where things get really hard, because even talking about this, right, I'm inclined to say, well, New Ageism is a religion because you can track it to, like, some kind of culturally located practices. The question is, you know, how deep does that entrenchment need to be?
Right. Yeah, and it's, I think it, time is really what determines what is religion versus what is spirituality. Like, that's, I think that's a fairly sure way of telling a distinction. Like, in the present age, No, you can't necessarily tease apart what you can just call spirituality versus what you can call religion, but 100, 200, 300 years from now, if that practice is still going on, okay, well, maybe it's more religion than spirituality because people are still holding on to it. There are certainly plenty of cases where, you know, there's an in fad and people do it for, you know, two or three generations and then you never hear about it again. And then there are people who try to rediscover it and then it turns into something new and people do that for another couple generations. And, you know, the cycle of sort of revitalizing or like Frankensteining spirituality back together through history is actually something that a lot of pagan traditions have had to contend with because there's not really source material for a lot of it,
right?
Either because there weren't written languages or written code for the people at the time who were practicing, you know, the oral tradition of these things, or they weren't really made known until after Christian evangelization happened, and then it was a bunch of monks and people like that translating all of these, you know, partially put together, you know, runic or Celtic texts and trying to translate them into Latin and just kind of doing the best that they could, but you never know what kind of biases may be imposed in that.
Yeah, and just to top it all off too, you have religious persecution and religious warfare intermingling in that, and so you have a lot of lost data, so to speak.
Yeah. Bye-bye, Alexandria.
Yeah, for real. But there's... And we can also talk about linguistics here because the term religion did used to indicate basically Christianity.
Right.
But now it's possible to talk about someone who, you know, plays football religiously, right?
Right.
So the reason why we bring all this up is because it's really important to say, because whenever you have a conversation about religion, you get into this quagmire of vagaries. So there's like generally two responses to this sort of problem. You either cast your net over broad and then you say, well, any strongly held belief is a religion, which yes. gets you into some weird territory, right? Because yeah. you talk about like Pastafarianism. You know what I mean? I mean, one might argue they don't actually closely hold their beliefs, but if someone did, right? But then they also get the other side of this where you cast your net too close and you end up excluding paganism
right.
and other like really valid forms of belief that we would like to protect under religious laws. And so bear that in mind in this conversation is what we're saying, because a lot of what we're talking about can sometimes get into this thick.
Right. And just stick around, because in our second half, we're going to be intermingling religion and politics. So if you're sitting around the dinner table right now, you'll probably want to just turn this off, forget about it, go back to eating dinner, and turn it back on after.
Yeah, put on your headphones.
Yeah. Yeah, we're the people your parents are warning you about. So in light of religion, as we're thinking about it being a community effort or some kind of... you know, group effort at a particular task or end. We want to talk about how religion functions in society, whether or not it's a moral good, neutral, bad, like we did in our previous episode with abortion, and just see where that goes. So what's our gut feelings about...
Okay.
Whether... We'll start with the gut, and then we'll go to the data. So gut feeling... Religion as a social institution, yay or nay?
You want to start?
Yeah, I can
start. I feel like you have more direct and straightforward opinions.
Oh, yeah. It's just good, right? So people can choose to do bad things in the name of their particular religious beliefs, and I can't think of a religious belief set that still exists that would not disavow those kinds of people. You know, it's just not the way it goes. Like, when you see Christians as they call themselves, you know, killing people for some religious end, like, that's not Christianity. Christianity is spread through compassion, love, kindness, and work. That's, like, that's how it is. So don't take the actions of bad people and somehow conflate that to the entire religious organization. Certainly the Catholic Church has been under fire with that through, you know, pedophilia scandals and things like that. And of course, that's terrible and should never happen. And I know Pope John Paul II was disgusted by that happening, and I believe he referred to it as the filth that had entered the church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lots of history projected through that and other instances. But so yes, I would say overall that religion plays an important social role. It gives people an opportunity to be in a community where, you know, like we said before, you all have a common narrative. It's very hard sometimes if you are a fringe person or an outcast or just very, very sort of independently minded, whether of your choosing or just, you know, of your disposition, to find a sense of community in something. So to have this institution here that, you know, hey, I can believe these things and do these things, and there are people around me to support that and to support me, not only in my, you know, work towards being, you know, the best person in this religion I can be, but just the best person in general I can be. And certainly some religions and some communities are far more supportive than others. I know just in my, you know, 2 or 3 months experience in this Orthodox church, everybody was super welcoming. Everybody was just like, you know, almost tripping over other people trying to introduce themselves. They were just all about, hey, there's somebody new. Oh my gosh, I have to introduce myself. They, you know, I want them to feel welcome. And that's huge, right? You're not going to grow your community by ignoring people that you don't recognize. You've got to just, you know, stick your hand out there, say hi, welcome, you know, be there. You know, people go to these places not sure if they necessarily want to be there, so give them a reason to come back would be my estimation of that. So I think I've hit everything I want to hit with that. So where are you at?
This might come as a surprise to you, but neutral.
Okay. Actually, not as surprising as... Yeah, that's... I get you.
Yeah, so I see everything that you're talking about. Where the reason I say neutral, though, is because to me, religious institutions function a lot like other social institutions. They're socially predictable, you know? And all of those things that you just stated, you can achieve through other institutions. The question would be, as we were saying earlier, whether or not those would count as religious institutions afterwards, right?
Right, yeah.
Quite possibly, once they reach that point, they would be considered religious. But, you know, you could take out... But the thing is that the reason I say neutral is because I think that there are a lot of potential ills. For instance, you said that, like, you know, they disavow bad people in the religion. I think that's broadly true. But the question about who gets to decide what is good and what is bad, especially when you're working on a narrative that not everyone shares, gets really complicated, right? And so I say neutral because you can have a lot of institutional badness that just doesn't get recognized as badness. And actually, the abortion topic is a perfect one, right? I completely disagree with you because I don't share your set of beliefs and practices.
Right.
And as a consequence, I believe that that's institutionally a bad thing. But yet, I agree it also has all of these enormous benefits. And so the way I come at this is, how do we capitalize on those benefits while minimizing the downsides? And one way to really grasp why I think this is because, as you had said, religions are monolithic. There are many different forms of Christianity, many different forms of Islam, many different forms of Hinduism, and to act like they don't have internal dialogue about these problems would also be wrong.
Right. Okay. It wasn't terribly surprising, I don't think.
Oh, okay, well.
I mean, was I expecting you to just start jumping up and down, just completely, you know, condemning religion and wanting to, you know, finally put it out, throw the bucket of water on the religious phoenix? I wasn't expecting that, to be honest with you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you think of me as such a reasonable individual.
I mean...
Or, well, I suppose that's under our narrative of reasonableness.
Ooh. Okay, yeah, fair. So I want to talk some data, some specifics, some impersonal source for why we might think of religion as a good or a bad thing. So here we go.
Do you want me to?
Well, you have the data, so, or at least some.
So the first data point that bears mentioning is that religious people tend to have better mental health. Interestingly, this somewhat depends on the character of your religious beliefs. So if I have a lot of positive religious beliefs, like God is there for me, God loves me, God supports me, your mental health fares better. But if you have a lot of negative religious beliefs, like God hates me, God has forsaken me, you actually have worse mental health. On the aggregate, it seems that most religious people have positive religious beliefs, and as a consequence, you know, they tend to do better.
Right.
And on top of that, too, you have, as you were saying, you know, the community and the practices and the grounding that provides, which can, incidentally, exacerbate either of these things. So if you have positive religious beliefs and a supportive religious community, yeah. But if you have negative religious beliefs and an unsupportive religious community, that could be really bad.
Yeah. And I think you could even extend that into, like, any group that has some kind of net social contract, mm-hmm. in a way. Just that, you know, we use religion here as our model, but I think it's probably applicable to other things as well. But certainly, if the community is not supportive, like you said, and, you know, is always condemning you for doing certain things, then, yeah, of course, you're going to have worse mental health. Because, like, here's the community that's trying to support me, and instead they're just, you know, condemning me for all of the bad things that I've done. Instead of saying, hey, you're not supposed to do that. Let me love you. Let me help you. Mm-hmm. Which is, that's how it's supposed to work, I think, for any religious organization that says you're not supposed to do certain things.
Yeah, that's how it ought to work for sure. I think the reality is sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I've been there. It's not great.
Yeah, and you would have another take on this too, right? Where I think, and actually, to be honest, I have a similar opinion too. Having that narrative and that structure to your life is really, really helpful.
Yeah.
Because I think that if you don't have any place in the world, any sense of belonging or purpose, it's really difficult. But religion offers this really profound source of meaning, which in itself is likely helpful in your mental health.
Oh, certainly. I don't know if I told you this story about how I came to be a philosophy major.
No, you never did.
All right, so, and it's perfectly related to this. This was my third semester, I think, in college, maybe fourth. I was terribly depressed. I was terribly anxious all the time. I was hardly getting marks in school at all. Like, I don't know how I passed anything. And then I was just like, all right, well, I've read some philosophy before, and all these people seem like they're depressed too, so maybe I'll just study philosophy. Like, I'll fit right in. So it's like, you know, the anxiety, the depression of just constantly overthinking is actually what drove me into something where the whole point was just to think everything. And was it helpful in, you know, relieving that depression and anxiety? No, it wasn't. It gave it a new face, gave it a new direction, but overall it was not quite as useful as one might think. And certainly I could have been doing any number of things differently, but that's how I came to be studying philosophy. So I don't remember where I was going with that.
Meaning.
Ultimately. Meaning. Yeah, okay, meaning. So, and ironically, I didn't really get along with anybody else in philosophy except, I think, you and a few other people, because I came into the program late, and so everybody else that was in these classes kind of already knew each other, from lower level philosophy classes and, you know, interest and things like that. So, you know, I was a bit of an outlier, a bit of an outsider coming into the program, but, you know, I found the few people that I got along with and just kind of, you know, tried to stick with them as much as I could. And that made it better. And I think that made me a better person and made me think better. But it was tricky, I think, coming into that like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I have a similar story, although I came out the other end as a humanist.
Well, I mean, as the old joke goes, you know, hey, you have an interesting personality. Thanks. It's a disorder in my case. So there's that, I think, might be a part of it. Potentially. So what's our next data point?
Next data point is religious people are also more charitable. But they usually give almost exclusively to those who share their religion. Much of those donations went to religious congregations.
Okay.
If you remove religious congregations, there's still, I think, like 60-70% more giving to religious organizations as opposed to non-religious organizations.
Sure.
Which is pretty interesting, I think, because on the one hand, it suggests that there's something powerful about this in-group mentality that you can utilize to achieve social ends.
Mm.
On the other hand, though, it does mean that you have some kind of out-group separation. How that compares to non-religious people is a little harder to say. I think in their wealth bracket, non-religious people give more to organizations in terms of percentage that don't share their religion. But that, like, probably goes mostly without saying.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder how many, you know, really, really, really well-off people are actually that religious.
Yeah. I think that the only really, really well-off religious person I can think of is the owner of Chick-fil-A, really.
Yeah. That's too bad.
Maybe. We won't have to get into it.
Yeah.
Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, we'll get... Maybe that will be a little hot take or something like that we'll do.
Oh, dude, it'll be... Yeah.
That'd be spicy.
That would be very spicy.
Yeah, and I just want to speak on that a little bit, I think. It's interesting. I mean, it's not surprising that religious people giving to their organizations is kind of a big percentage of what they give, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, the, like, religious institutions get tax-exempt status because they're not businesses per se. A lot of churches you could consider as nonprofits, which would be tax-exempt anyhow. So that, like, that makes sense. I guess where it gets a little bit muddy is, you know, somebody like Joel Osteen or something like that. Who,
I have.
Ugh!
Mega churches.
Yeah, mega churches, televangelists. You know, if you just put $63 in this envelope with this paper prayer rug. You know, God's going to save you. It makes me hurt. It makes me hurt that somebody would take advantage of somebody like mm-hmm. that and then claim that it's the will of God. That hurts me. But more to the point, I can't think of a particular large religion that doesn't have some kind of giving dogma, right?
Yeah, most of them do.
And a lot of them even, and of course a lot of them have like their own support charities and things like that in the world doing the work. So, you know, you don't have to necessarily, you know, spend the money doing the work yourself. You can spend the money giving it to somebody who's already doing it, their work, to further their work. Not that you shouldn't also do your work, but just, you know, as an extension of that.
Yeah, for sure.
Next point.
So, the next point, you already touched on it, but
okay.
Religious institutions are social institutions, and it's important to bear that in mind when you're thinking about them.
Sure.
Catholic Church and sex abuse scandals is a really good example
of course.
Of when these things can go awry, specifically because, and I bring the Catholic Church up not because you're Catholic, but because it's a really telltale example, because that case involves corruption up and down, not only just the Catholic Church itself, but surrounding government institutions.
Right.
A lot of police officers were involved in protecting the church from bad reputation. In the resources, there'll be some links to the scandals, particular scandals we're talking about. The two that are worth reading is the Murphy Report and the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Investigation.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. But this exists also in other institutions as well. Islam has a way of radicalizing people in desperate situations. I don't want to comment too much on that, but to say that Islam plays no role in terrorism in the Middle East would be wrong.
Oh, certainly.
And the reason I bring this up is because you can trace these things to say either it's the religion, or if you want to be more like contextually aware, they deal with problems that galvanize this sort of fighting mentality in their population.
Right.
And they're a social institution. So, right. Of course, they're going to bear some resemblance to. Like, if you didn't have Islam there and you replaced it with some kind of secular social institution, you'd probably see something similar.
Right. Yeah, it would just, you know, if somebody's angry, they'll find a reason to justify their anger.
Exactly.
So... And that's the end thing now. It's just finding that institution to justify your anger and get mad at somebody about it.
Right. It's just the set of beliefs that you have and then the institutions that back them. And the ways in which these things intermingle is what produces a lot of these problems.
Right. And that's not to say, like, in the, you know, sex abuse scandal cases, like, There should be, you know, people should be calling out, like, actually bad people in whatever organization. But then, you know, it's not the organization's fault that somebody is bad, per se. It's probably not. And certainly, if you know anything about the organization, you'll probably be able to make a pretty good guess as to whether or not that's true.
Yeah.
But it's so easy, and it's done so much. People will see a bad person do a bad thing that is part of some affiliation, social organization, religious organization, be like, ha, see, it's the organization, just like I said. Like every organization is some, you know, Illuminati evil cult thing that is just perpetuating terrible things all over the world.
Where I agree with you is, one case doesn't prove, actually, well, I would say any number of cases can't justify an organization having a problem intrinsically.
Right.
However, the more cases build up, the more we have reason to believe that there is, and there are ways in which you can analyze an organization upon the face of it. In the Catholic Church, I do think that there are ways in which these beliefs in the institution work itself to protect the sex abuse scandals. And I don't know if you want to talk specifics about that, but
all that I really, there's a, again, I'm going to bring up Father Mike Schmitz again from Ascension Presents. He did a video about the Pennsylvania scandals, in particular, and, talks a little bit about like his feelings about it and how things went on. And of course he was, if you watch any of his other videos and then watch that one, like he is in a completely different disposition. He's, you know, very visibly angry about the whole situation. Actually cries at one point about it, like just thoroughly enraged by it. But he said there were people dropping the ball at many levels of the institution. And that's not necessarily a reflection of the institution having a faulty system of authority, but certainly the people that they put as authority figures were not the people that needed to be there. You don't want people in those positions who are just going to say, oh, this person's getting accused of something. Okay, well, we're just going to move them. We're just going to move you to a different diocese. Like, that doesn't really solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Like, sure, if there's mumblings about something going on, you know, you have to investigate it a little bit. You can't just, like, send them somewhere else and assume that the behavior's going to change. And that's, yeah, that's all I'll say about that.
Okay, yeah. It might help to draw an analogy to what I mean more particularly to, I don't know if we disagree about this, but, policing in America is like a secular example of what I mean by a social institution carrying problems as a social institution.
Okay.
And the reason I bring up policing is because I can give you more better specifics. Like police departments tend to investigate themselves. The people who would judge on the case of internal police investigations are people who have to work with the police officers. Police have unions, which means that they are out to protect each other's backs. And as a consequence, they have this kind of tribalistic mentality that really disincentivizes other police officers reporting on the bad conduct of other police officers. Well, those three alone is, I think, sufficient to say. It's like, well, there's an institutional problem here.
Right.
All of the bad police actions don't culminate in institutional problems. But when you look at the specifics of the incentives facing police officers and their conduct and the consequences of their conduct, it's pretty clear, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's – you can't necessarily have an institution – keeping an eye on itself. Like, obviously there are some things that the institution has to do internally because of privacy or security or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly having an external body that is, you know, not biased in favor of protecting that said organization is huge. And I don't think enough organizations really have that.
No. For sure. And this is the American government model is actually predicated really on this. Like, there's a whole idea of checks and balances, right? You have external bodies constantly checking another body to prevent, you know, excesses of power and that. Of course, you know, we can talk about whether or not the government is like really three separate entities and like a whole slew of things, but, you know.
Or whether or not that was effective.
Yeah, right. Like, we can talk about, you know, how the institution actually operates, but that's what I mean. You know, social institutions bear these sorts of issues and the way that they set themselves up, the way the power structure works, the way the incentives work for the people inside those organizations, etc. I would even go so far to say that institutions kind of form their own hyper-object in which they are, like, things unto themselves.
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
I think that's sufficient
for that.
What's next? What's our next data?
So this is the last point on this section of the episode. Shame tends to lead to externalizing behavior and substance abuse, and this can tie into certain religious beliefs.
Okay.
So I have two specifics here. gay people tend to have higher levels of substance abuse due to the shame they feel, and this is exacerbated by religious perspectives on them. And the second thing is, people with traditional sexual beliefs tend to have higher porn consumption than more sexually deviant tastes. Deviant. I use that word in like the technical sense. I don't like, that's not moral opprobrium. It's like literally like two standard deviations away from what is normal.
Yeah. I guess I'll hit that second point first. I think those two things are actually the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like that guilt or shame leads to those things. Like,
yeah.
It's not surprising that organizations that shame people for actions without also trying to love them or care for them or, you know, bring them back away from whatever their, you know, guilted action is, makes all the difference, right? Because if I kill someone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the justice system now is, you know, I go, I'm guilty of it, and then, you know, boom, door's locked, you know, that's it, you screwed up, and you bear that shame without any kind of real help.
Rehabilitation, you're talking?
Right.
Yeah.
And so, the better way to handle something, not necessarily murder, but just like, you know, sin or wrong action or however the particular organization defines it, is like, yes, recognize that somebody did something wrong in the light of that organization, but also let them understand, like, yeah, we all screw up. It's fine. Like, I mean, it's not like fine, but, you know, let's help this person. And that's, I think that's the biggest thing. And again, the practitioners of said religion or members of certain organizations should not be the standard for judging the organization itself.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there are lots of, you know, lots of Christians who are called to love that are seriously hateful, which is not cool. Don't do that. It's not what you're supposed to do. But that's, yeah.
Yeah, I think that sums it up really, really nicely, because, and this gets at, I think, our mutual perspectives, really, because I believe that it's neutral, because if you look, it heavily depends on what those beliefs are.
Right.
If they're positive, good beliefs, and a supportive culture, it's very, very valuable to a lot of people. But if the beliefs are negative, shameful, and unsupportive, they can actually lead to the exact opposite.
Right.
And so really, it's about crafting these institutions in ways that are really helpful to most people. And I think that you would think that a lot of religions are that, and your church is.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. You know, just having a conversation with the priest after church as I'm, you know, in classes to actually formally join the church. You know, we talked a little bit about confession, because I think that's what, one of the things that gives people a bad taste about Catholicism is confession, because they think it's this, you know, organized system of guilting people into conformity. And that's not really true. It's, as the priest put it at my church, he said, you know, bear the shame now in confessing it so that you don't have to bear it after you're dead, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, get it off your back, you know, let that be what it is. And that's, you know, that's what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a place where you can, you know, go and say, hey, look, I screwed up because I'm a human being and human beings screw up with this kind of stuff. And you can get forgiveness and you can do your penance and you can, you know, get back on the right path and you'll screw up again. And it's this, you know, recycling process of, you know, hey, I did something wrong. Okay, come and ask formally for forgiveness for that thing that you did wrong, and then trust that it's forgiven. And that last point is really the most important thing, is that, like, mm-hmm. when the priest says it's forgiven, like, it is, you have to trust that. You have to have faith in that, one might say.
Mm-hmm.
So is this break time?
Yeah, that concludes part one of our episode. Come back for part two. We'll be talking about how religion should be treated by the state.
So what do we do for a break time? Are we just going to sit here and talk about nothing for 5 minutes so people can just pause or skip past it? I'm too lazy to edit this out.
Oh. Welcome back to Sapientia. I'm Justin.
And I'm James. Still, thankfully.
Thankfully. Or are you?
Well,
your skin's a little different. Your cells have been replenished a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no. Well, I did shave. Did I nick myself? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you can't win them all.
So, for the second part of this episode, we're going to be focusing on how states should treat religion. So, we have a few grounding notes before we start. And it's about the character of a state, because it's very important to say this. It's really, really missed. Number one, states are inherently coercive entities.
That's sounding a bit anarchist right there. No, I know what you mean, though.
Yeah. Well, this is the anarchist observation. And while it doesn't necessarily get you to anarchism, it does mean that a state has to be justified. Like, it's presumptively wrong to coerce someone, right?
Right.
And you can provide a justification for it. Just like, you know, killing is a good example. In a vacuum, killing someone's probably bad.
Right.
But, you know, if they're coming at you with an axe, you know, if they're coming at you with a gun, you know, if they've already killed someone and you just watch them kill someone, now they're coming at you, you know, like, you can make the situation worse and worse and worse. And at some point, you know, it's like, okay, you can justify it.
Right. Okay.
Second thing is that states have a monopoly on violence. Typically, but for the most part, almost all violent capacity is controlled and regulated by a state. And this is really important. This isn't a bad thing, actually. This is, in some ways, a good thing. Because one thing that states can do that non-state societies can't is stop wars.
True that.
So, but it does mean that now you have an institution that's not only coercive, but also holds all of the violent power, which makes it, you know, a little more wary, right?
Yeah. You don't want to cross it. Yeah, basically. For certain.
Because, yeah, think, you know, they could just throw you in prison, or they can execute you. And, like, what are you going to do about it? You know?
Yeah, that's not good. I'll find Alex Jones. He's got a couple of 50 cals in his studio, yeah, apparently.
No. If you're Alex Jones, look, you're fine. But everyone else has got a problem.
Yeah. Maybe he's too far out there. The government doesn't want him.
Yeah, well, you know, look, he's onto them.
All right, and our last note is that states often govern disparate populations. And so I think that idea that America is a melting pot of all sorts of different places in the world is actually false. Because it's essentially a large collection of individual and separate microcosa that just all happen to exist in one border. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, like, California looks nothing like Maine.
No.
Like, both in culture and, like, in politics. Well, I mean, we're liberal. We share a lot of things. And I think that's largely due to the internet, but, like, yeah, especially pre-internet.
Oh, yeah.
California and Maine were just, like, almost entirely separate entities.
Yeah, and, well, the interesting thing, too, is that, like, if you want to become a lawyer in California, you have to take the California bar. Mm-hmm. And there are schools in California specifically for you to study law to be a lawyer in California. It's like a completely separate entity from the U.S. bar. Mm-hmm. Is the California bar, because that's a more, like, you know, statistical, here's a difference, but that, I think, you know, can be as much of a cultural difference as anything else.
No, absolutely. You have different governing entities, and especially specifically the U.S., but this is also true in other, you know,
other states. Like India, for instance, has a Muslim population, they have a Hindu population, they have a sizable Christian population, and they're incredibly geographically dispersed. And on top of that, they speak like 11 languages over there.
Yeah, it's something like, kind of obscene.
In one country, and then you have one state that has to govern all of that.
Yeah. Well, that's like, yeah, because Spain has, of course, everybody speaks. I forget what the Iberian Spanish, because it's a little bit different than Latin American and South American Spanish. But then there are like, what, 7 or 8 regions of Spain that all have their own languages.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the ones near the Pyrenees speak French also, and people near Portugal also speak Portuguese, and some of them speak there was the whole caliphate in Spain, so there's also Hindi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just there's anyway.
Right. So with that in mind, whenever we talk about how states should treat religion, these three things pose serious impediments. And so just keep that in mind as we're going through this conversation.
Arabic, not Hindi. My apologies.
Yeah. I mean, some language. Yeah, that was really off. But.
Oh my God. Wow. Okay. Anyway.
Hey, I didn't catch it, so look.
All right, so where are we starting off?
I think the easiest place to start is the secular position, because it's the standard view of most people, and honestly, most philosophers, I feel like.
Okay.
So the secular position is literally indifference to or rejection or exclusion of religion and religious considerations. Essentially, that states should not enforce or prohibit religious exercise. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think people would argue against something like that. I mean, I think a majority of the arguments that I have heard against things like that are either the really extreme outliers on both ends of the "this is how I view religious institutions" spectra, from the all religions should be, you know, mandated as unlawful. And then there's the other side where it says my religion should be mandated as lawful.
Well, it does get us into some interesting conundrums here, too. I think that there are fairly good criticisms of the standard view, mainly because one thing that's weird about it is you treat religion as this thing as distinct from other things,
right?
So religious institutions are separate from secular institutions. Religious thought is separate from secular thought. And there's a real good reason to doubt whether or not you can categorize that easily.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and that's... Actually, we were just having this discussion a few seconds... or before we started filming, mm-hmm. about, you know, we were talking about how, you know, a theologian would kind of define as like a philosopher of religion. And of course, lots of different religions can have theologians, and they do. But like, philosophers aren't inherently theologians.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting that you can just kind of, or shouldn't just like, yeah, religion is like this thing, and then there's just everything else.
Yeah.
Because it's so personal. It's so interlocking inside and between people, intrapersonal and interpersonal, that's impossible, right? Like,
it's really hard, at least.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that it's impossible. I'm going to make the stronger claim here. Of course, you know, not to use I don't remember what word I'm looking for, personal experience fallacy, basically, as evidence of some kind of universal trend. But, okay, very hard.
There is, before we move on from the secular stance, I think it does bear mentioning at least one of the ways this works out in philosophy.
Okay.
So there's this doctrine of religious restraint, which is typical of the standard view, which I think characterizes it best. So the doctrine of religious restraint is: a citizen of a liberal democracy may support the implementation of a coercive law L just in case he reasonably believes himself to be in possession of a plausible secular justification for L, which he is prepared to offer in political discussion. So, in effect, what this means is that I am motivated by some secular reason, so it does not grounded on any tradition or religious claim.
Right.
There's a few arguments for why this is, and we can delve into them, but I'll state them all at the top for ease. The three biggest arguments are: one, it prevents religious warfare; two, it prevents religious sectarianism and divisiveness; and three, it actually promotes religious welfare and respect by respecting other people's religious perspectives.
Sure. Can I read that really quick?
Sure thing.
If you wanna, talk about this works.
The one thing to bear in mind is that the doctrine of religious restraint is a individual restriction. It's not saying that the state should enforce it. What it means is that it is morally wrong to legislate on the basis of your religious beliefs, as i.e. is wrong to vote that abortion should be illegal and women should be jailed for it because I have that religious conviction. I have to be motivated by some secular justification. And the easy way to see how this bears out is it means that if most people are moral in your society and are obeying the doctrine of religious restraint, you'll get a society, a pluralistic society, as healthy as can be, as opposed to the ones that have this religious divisiveness, religious warfare, and disrespect for minority religions.
Okay. Yeah. And the I think that's been a bit topical lately, in terms of people wanting to see potential changes to, let's say, the First Amendment with, like, as it relates to religion, because the wording, if I remember correctly, is just that the state shall not enforce some state-sponsored religion, basically. So, essentially meaning that as long as your religion does not violate the laws of the state in its practices, you can practice it. Or you can practice your religion except for those practices which violate the laws of the state. Which I think has fairly well managed to keep a nice balance of you can have your practices, but also you have to be respectful of other people's practices. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there have been issues with that, and obviously people like to take issue with religion because they think it turns people into crazy dogmatic zealots, and sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Certainly, that's not false to say, but that, I think what we have going on right now, at least in the U.S., is a fairly balanced system for dealing with, like, how the state interplays with religion. I mean, I would disagree with the doctrine of religious restraint on some level, insofar as your political beliefs or ideologies are inherently characterized by your experience to some degree. Like, mm-hmm. And that experience could be reading a political philosophy book.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So whatever experiences you've had in your life govern what your thoughts are. And for some people, they don't go any farther than just regurgitating what they've always heard their parents say. Some don't go any farther than just rejecting everything that their parents have said. And, you know, whatever, if they want to bury their head in the ground about issues and just, you know, oh, I'm just going to make sure I say the opposite of whatever this person says because I don't like him. Whatever. You're not educated about it, presumably, but that's fine. But I don't think that religious conviction, because it is so much, experience. It is so much of an experience of personhood can necessarily be ruled out as any kind of justification, whether it be even, or shall I say, even if it does exist in a primarily secular-oriented society.
Yeah. No, I actually, incidentally, I do agree with you here. I like how you said that, like, it's characterized by your experience. At first, I was wondering where you're going with that. But I see it now. The thing is that all of your ideas are culturally located. Or it's not... We can have a talk about, like, epistemology, whether or not, like, about subjectivity, objectivity, and whether or not there is objective truth. But it's true to say that any ideas you have had to be introduced to you by your environment. And on top of that, you know, the value, even more fundamentally, the values you have will be informed by your life experience, by your heritage, by, you know, the culture that you were raised in, whether or not that's in the form of acceptance or rejection. And when you have the DRR, it gets really confusing why you would say, well, this tradition is secular, therefore we allow it, whereas this one isn't. And then you get into that hairy situation of, well, what counts as religion? Right? If I'm a, like, I can, if I'm like a diehard virtue ethicist in the spirit of Aristotelian ethics, and I believe, like, really hard and fast in those set of values and principles, and then carry that forward in my life, why is that functionally different than a religious person doing that?
Yeah, exactly. It's not different at all, really. And that's, I think that's kind of where that the secular mindset even trips over itself, is just exactly that point. If you're purely secular, then religion as a philosophical entity has no more or less correctness than any other philosophical identity.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, actually, glad you said that, because the way secularism gets formalized is be like either one, right? Some people take it as complete neutrality. Other people say you have to completely exclude it. Right. And there's, like, all sorts of variation in there.
Well, and complete exclusion wouldn't even be secular anymore. That would be state-sponsored atheism.
Yeah, and that's been a charge against that. In fact, actually, it might be useful to go straight to traditionalism then, since that's where we're at now.
Sure.
So I think that probably neither of us is going to end up being traditionalists, but it does bear mentioning.
All right.
So we're recognizing then that it's, like, really hard to say, okay, well, this set of values is non-religious, so we accept it, versus this one is religious and we don't accept it, regardless of how you want to characterize religion.
Right.
If you recognize that it's hard to do that and you believe that it's a genuine problem, one way to slice this is, okay, you can't solve it, so just embrace it. Your state has to endorse a set of values. And in fact, liberal democracies do.
Right.
They endorse, you know, religious freedom, they endorse right to freedom of speech. And while it seems self-evident to us, why would we all want to do that? You know, if you're talking about, I don't want to delve into the Chinese Hong Kong problems now, but if you're talking about, like, you know, a typical Chinese citizen who's very supportive of the communist regime, they obviously don't buy those ideas.
Right.
So traditionalists say, your state's going to sponsor a set of values. And that's how it's going to be.
Yeah. Well, and I almost don't even think that a state can escape that kind of structure of values, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, whether it's, you know, lots of the Constitution were written by people who had more or less Christian viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So the values upheld in the Constitution are informed by them, certainly, to no small extent. And so maybe I'm not entirely representing traditionalism correctly, but I don't think it's even... Can we even say that it would be possible for a state to not uphold a set of values? Is a state not in itself a self-projecting set of values onto other people?
Oh, yeah. And that's exactly the insight. It has to be. So the question is, and this is the typical counter-argument against traditionalism, right? if we have to endorse a set of values, do we endorse a thick set of values that are robust and complete, or do we endorse a thin set of values that you can have a plurality of views and conceptions of the good within? So is my commitment so strong as to say, this is what is moral and you have to abide by it, or the state's going to enact violence against you, or is it, this is the baseline in which you cannot trespass, but if you want to engage in XYZ behavior and the state doesn't have a compelling interest in saying that's a bad thing, okay.
Yeah. And I think the more towards the thinner side is probably the better option in mm-hmm. most cases. We can see throughout history regimes that have attempted to have those thick value sets, like the Third Reich, the communists in the Soviet Union and in China and in Latin and South America, and, you know, Mussolini in Italy. Like, it's all and I try to pick people on both sides of the political spectrum just so I'm not like trying to cherry pick the worst of one side. It's, you know, they had enforced doctrines and they just rounded up people en masse and killed them for not supporting them. Like, that's, how could you have a sound moral institution that can round up people and just kill them for not thinking the right way?
Yeah. This gets into like really complicated questions of whether or not they were legitimate states. You know what I mean? Which, that's a whole nother podcast.
That one might have to come up.
I think so. It's definitely worth talking about. But yeah, I think that you're exactly right. And I would even add too, you can imagine a perfect state that has a thick conception of values that is entirely forgiving and rehabilitative and stuff. You're still at some level coercively forcing people into a certain conception of the good.
Yeah.
Which may or may not match their life experience and their, you know, their ideologies and what even is good for them, you know, like what makes their lives fulfilling.
Certainly.
But I think it's bears thinking about, because how thick you want your moral conception of the state, that's actually a really hard problem.
Yeah. Well, and so, and just to pin out the easy ones, like, you need it thick enough so that the value structure that the state imposes are to the benefit of the state, right? So, murder being, you know, illegal benefits the state because if people could run around murdering people, the state would collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Either because people would kill the state officials, which they try to do anyway, or, you know, enough people would die in the constituency that there wouldn't really be the state wouldn't support anything anymore. And then I don't know if taxation necessarily falls into a value, but
yeah.
I mean, I guess that would fall under like responsibility. You have a, you know, you get X, Y, and Z benefits and you have A, B, and C responsibilities to contribute to your state for having those benefits. I don't know if that necessarily counts.
No, it does, certainly, because what if I'm like a hardcore libertarian? I believe that taxation is fundamentally wrong and intrinsically wrong, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, does the state have a compelling interest to say, no, you got to pay taxes even though you believe them? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I thought you were an AMCAP.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely an AMCAP. How dare the state? Look, I think there shouldn't be states at all. Let me tell you.
Yeah, we don't need states. Why we just need markets.
Why would you want to stop wars? They're profitable.
yeah. That's pretty much where we're at in this country at this point. All right. So stepping away from that literal minefield.
The last one is the pluralist stance. So this is I don't think it's best to understand this as in between secularism and traditionalism. It's really just its own separate thing that borrows from secular ideas, but recognizes this as a genuine problem. So the difference between the secular stance and the pluralist stance really is that in the pluralist stance, you treat religion like any other conception of the good and of human behavior, like of human life. And what this means is that, for one, the doctrine of religious restraint doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Right.
For pluralists, they think that it would be better if you had a secular motivation. And in fact, because you are living in a pluralistic society, you ought to look for one. But in the absence of finding one, either because you're just incapable of doing so or because you don't find any persuasive ones, saying that you shouldn't be able to use the lights of your own reason, even within a religious tradition, would be, in effect, to reduce the liberties of religious people. And this is a really interesting problem. Martha Nussbaum points it out this way. Religions tend to be oppressive to women. But what if a woman wants to be a part of that religion, doesn't find it oppressive to themselves, and it's a source of profound meaning for them?
Right. Well, and that's just who defines oppressive.
Yeah.
Like,
it gets, yeah.
That's, oppression is less about, I think in a lot of cases, it's less about objectivism and more about subjectivism. Like, sure, certainly there are things that are objectively oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, literally beating somebody until they do work for you is, that's like kind of inherently oppressive. I don't think anybody would say that they want that done to themselves. And if you do, ask yourself why. You might change your mind. But that's just it. Like, I saw this really hilarious comic. It pops up every so often, but it's a Muslim woman and just some other woman wearing a bikini walking by each other. And of course, the Muslim woman is, you know, covered head to toe except for her eyes. And they're both looking at each other and saying, wow, their culture oppresses women so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah. Like, is it freedom to wear as little as you want or as possible and look as good as possible doing it? Or is it culturally oppressive? Like, I you could make a pretty strong argument that that's as much oppressive from a kind of external sense as perhaps, you know, total subjugation or, you know, total body covering.
Yeah, exactly. And Martha Nussbaum points this out too. This is why I love her writing, because she always is very careful to not try to give like precise answers when none are really there.
Are you saying she's nuanced enough?
Yeah, she's nuanced enough, let me tell you.
Excellent.
But the way she resolves this is she recognizes that you have a capacity of religious belief, we ought to foster that in people who want to use it. But on the other hand, you know, there are other capabilities that we also have to be protective of. And so it's really a fine balancing act. And in the end of one of her chapters on the role of religion in her book, Women and Human Development, she even points out that there will inevitably be some loss involved no matter which direction you go. Like, it's impossible to kind of craft a situation that works perfectly for everyone.
Right.
And that's where a lot of the tragedy in these cases come from, because, you know, states are coercive and they also govern disparate populations.
Right. Yeah. And the idea that you can make something that works for everyone is kind of nonsense anyway.
Yeah.
Like, eventually, like, obviously, some people like killing other people. And in a country like this, that's not going to fly. You know, that's not the fault of the, it's not the fault of the state. It's, you know, it's, you can't please everyone. And you have to, you know, set your thin or thick value systems, to draw back a little bit,
mm-hmm.
into where do we draw the lines in trying to make, if we're going to make it unfair, how do we make it as fairly unfair as possible? How do we make it unfair kind of across the board?
Yeah.
I get, if you want to call it that, like almost like the opposite of utilitarianism or something. Is it, I guess that wouldn't really be the opposite of utilitarianism. No, trying to make it as least bad, but for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. But one last point I'd like to make about pluralism before we move on to our personal beliefs in this, where we stand. And you had alluded to this earlier, but I like to bring it out fully.
Sure.
My favorite part of a pluralism is it treats people as people. Right. You know, instead of taking this as generic citizen X, right, with like some set of beliefs Y, you know, which may or may not be religious, you say, well, this is a Muslim woman, you know, this is a Christian guy, you know, this is a non-binary atheist, and you have to legislate for all three of these people.
Right.
You know, and recognizing that these three people all believe they have the right answers, because otherwise, why would they believe the things they do?
Right.
And that's where the trickiness comes in, and this is why pluralism helps in really defining out that you're legislating for real people, and these legislations have real effects on their lives, and so how do you mediate those differences?
Yeah, and that's... Some places do that a lot better than others.
Yeah.
What do I think about that? What do I think about pluralism? It works, mostly, right? Certainly, if you're trying to find a way to govern all three of those people who have vastly different conceptions of being right, yeah, good luck. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we try to make our best stab at it, but, you know, it falls short at times, certainly. And it's interesting, too, that we can conceive of a state that has a stake in your beliefs,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's like, you know, there's the one hand that it's like, well, the state doesn't really care who or what you are. It only cares that you are a constituent of the state, which kind of works. But at the same time, like you said, we're talking about individual people.
Hmm.
And you can't just, you know, blanket out something that excludes a large portion of the people that you're talking about. I would say large being, you know, like double digits of percent of people in the mm-hmm. constituency, perhaps. You know, the chances of you passing legislation that doesn't, you know, negatively impact plus or minus 2% of the population, it's pretty small. Good luck finding a piece of legislation that you can pass that doesn't make somebody mad, or, you know, exclude some group from something. But I think pluralism is the best shot at some kind of aggregate democracy, if you want to call it that. Some kind of, you know, we have what we have and we're just going to make do.
Yeah. I think I'm there too. I'm pluralist, but between secularism and traditionalism, I'm closer to secularism. The way I like to frame this is we want to maximize the disparate conceptions of the good that could exist, while also recognizing that people have... Basically, you want a thin conception of the good at the state level, and that should be generally consensus-driven, such that it's things like, well, you don't want to be killed.
Right.
I mean, no one wants to be killed. I hate to draw on libertarianism, but I'm gonna do it.
All right, let's do it.
The non-aggression principle doesn't, it's not perfect, but it does work here in particular. If person X wants to exercise their religious belief and it doesn't hurt anyone else, it's probably fine. And I don't think the state has a compelling interest in legislating about that.
Right.
If it causes some minor inconveniences and it's based on your tradition and your general, your strongly held beliefs, then I think that we can make some affordances. And I think that's the best way to look at it. So, to returning to our abortion issue, I believe that the state shouldn't be legislating about that, because this affects, I mean, by not allowing women to have abortion, you are, in effect, negating a lot of the life experience of those women.
Right.
And I think that the state doesn't really have a compelling interest in keeping what is contentiously non-people around. But on the other hand, like, I don't want to say Muslim women can't wear burqas in their driver's license photos. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, if you're... Well, why would they have driver's licenses?
Hey, I mean, look.
Well, or just any kind of identification. I mean, you're not... presumably not going to see them without them on anyway, so...
I mean, the hijab. Wait, no, I'm thinking of the hijab, aren't I? The head covering is what I'm thinking of, not the face covering.
Oh, forgive our ignorance on this. There are lots of words for various head coverings and keeping them all straight in a place that has like 93% white population is a bit tricky.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. But in any case, I think my point is clear. Like, if you just want to wear a head covering in your driver's license photo and you have a compelling traditional reason for doing so, I don't see why the state would say you can't do that.
Right. Well, and I think it's also important, too, like, how does the age of said tradition compare to the age of the state?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, traditions that have been around for, you know, 1,000+ years are pretty solid, they're steadfast, they're probably not going to change very much or go much of anywhere. So, certainly in that case, it's like, well, okay, here's... You know, we're living in a country that's, you know, only, you know, burgeoning on, what, 250 years?
Yeah.
So, what, you know, what real ground do they stand on to try to govern traditions that are, you know, 1,200 years old? Not a lot, I wouldn't say. But that's also, I think, I would pin myself more on the traditionalist side of pluralism, though still keeping a relatively thin definition of the good, recognizing that lots of people have different understandings, but that there may be some kind of legitimate compromise, as you said, to thicken that definition slightly for general welfare, just for goodness sake.
Yeah, quite literally, actually.
Yeah, for real. Hey, wow, I said that phrase and it was literal this time. Yeah, the one time ever. So where does that leave us? I think we're at the end of our note sheet.
Yeah, we are. You want to close out?
Oh, yeah, we can close out. Well, you wanted to end with something in particular, but I think we just did that.
Yes.
Okay, well, cool. So, thanks for watching. Make sure you check out our Facebook page. Check out our Patreon, because we posted our first Hot Takes episode. It's about cannibalism. It's great. Won't go any farther than that. But, well, maybe I'll put in just a little snippet from the end of it right here. But, so check that out. Just, you know, support us if you want to. Would mean a lot. That'd be great. It's the prudent thing to do. Also, next episode, I think we decided was pseudoscience.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so we're probably working on pseudoscience. That's going to be a tie-in. Do we want to reveal what the next big episode is?
Intellectual property.
So you might think that pseudoscience is a weird tie to that, but, you know, just be patient with us. It's going to be good. It should tie nicely. And if there's some change in that, we'll let you know. Any closing thoughts, Justin?
Yeah, that's all I got. All
right. Well, thanks for watching or listening wherever you're at. If you don't want to watch, check us out on Anchor FM or Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. I don't know. Wherever you get your podcasts from, I think is the correct term. And if you're just listening to us, come check us out on YouTube, because sometimes we make funny faces and point at each other. Have a good one.